Welcome to the Swallow Your Pride podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Richard. I'm a board-certified specialist in swallowing and swallowing disorders, a mobile fees business owner, and founder of the MedSLP Collective. This podcast is all about delivering the latest evidence-based practice to medical SLPs everywhere. Whether you're a new clinician seeking tangible tools for treatment or a seasoned vet stuck in a rut, my goal is to help ditch the old-school ways of the past that no longer serve you or your patients, to reinvigorate your passion for our field, to broaden your knowledge about our scope of practice, and to inspire you to practice at the top of your license. So if you're listening, I encourage you to swallow your pride, be open and willing to learn, because let's face it, your patients deserve that kind of care. With that, let's dive right in. Just a quick disclaimer that all statements and opinions expressed in this episode do not reflect on the organizations associated with the speakers and are their own opinions solely. Right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Swallow Your Pride podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Rabab Rangwala. She's an SLP and postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, San Francisco. Her research focuses on the neural and behavioral control of swallowing and speech across healthy and clinical populations. Her work in dysphagia examines respiratory swallow coordination and objective assessment of swallowing impairments using wearable sensors, particularly in individuals with Parkinson's disease and other neurologic conditions. In parallel, she conducts speech neuroscience research using neuroimaging, psychophysics, and computational modeling to understand how the brain supports complex motor behaviors such as speech production. By integrating clinical insight with neuroscience and quantitative methods, Dr. Rangwala's work seeks to improve our understanding of speech and swallowing disorders, with the goal of informing healthcare delivery, guiding treatment decisions, and ultimately improving patient quality of life. All right. Hello, Rabab.
Hi, and hi, everyone. It's nice to meet you all.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been following along with your work on LinkedIn, and one day I was like, I've got to reach out to her and see if we can get her on the show, because I think you're doing such cool, really, really translational research. It's really nerdy scientific stuff, but stuff that I think that clinical SLPs just love. So thank you for doing the work that you do, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. I have also been following your work.
Oh, thank you.
And I've really enjoyed the podcast. Like I say, I think I'm a clinician first, a researcher second. I worked clinically before I went to Northwestern to do my PhD. So I think a lot of that clinical experience has informed my research decision-making, my projects, manuscripts, my research questions primarily. So it's been I like to think it's a melting pot of all the experiences I've had.
Awesome. Awesome. Share a little bit about yourself, if you will, where your desire to do this work come from.
Yes, I grew up in India and I did my undergrad there in a government hospital. Things are very different in developing countries. We started seeing patients outside out of undergrad. So I had a lot of rich clinical exposure there while I studied / worked and did an internship. I worked clinically for a little bit there before I moved to the U.S. to do my graduate education at the University of Texas at Dallas. It was a great program. I learned so much. My professors were amazing. And then I started working clinically. And I just had a lot of itching research questions related to dysphagia. So I spent my clinical fellowship year, while I was working clinically, just trying to think about those questions, be a clinician, reading research, keeping up with podcasts just like yours, reading a lot of blog posts and expert opinions and research studies. And then I decided to go back for my PhD and find an answer to all of those questions. I'm still finding a lot of answers. but it's baby steps, and it's got me a little bit closer, which I see as an accomplishment.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you for that. Where should we start?
I'm happy to share a little bit about my work in Parkinson's disease. That has been a focus of my research work over the past few years at Northwestern. And maybe after I can share something not so dysphagia related, but my work at UCSF right now.
Yeah, perfect.
At Northwestern, I looked at respiratory swallow coordination and swallowing impairment in patients with Parkinson's disease. This was a part of a Michael J. Fox funded project awarded to my mentor at Northwestern. And I did my doctoral education leading and primarily contributing to that project. So my dissertation focused on 31 individuals with Parkinson's disease. And I'm happy to share that the paper came out a few weeks ago in the Journal of Speech Language during research. So it is focusing on respiratory swallow coordination and its association with swallowing impairment in Parkinson's. We had quite a few interesting results. The first one was that patients with Parkinson's disease do have impaired swallowing compared to a group of healthy age-matched individuals or controls. Second, we found that they have a greater frequency of inhaling before they are swallow. For those who aren't very familiar with how respiratory swallow coordination works, we typically exhale, we swallow, and then we exhale again. So each swallow happens during the phase of breathing out or during exhalation, and there's a temporary pause in the breath, which allows the swallow to occur. But instead of seeing the typical exhale, swallow, exhalation pattern, we saw that patients with Parkinson's inhale before they swallow more frequently than healthy controls. They ran another association looking at the phase before the swallow and swallowing impairment using the MBS-IMP protocol. So we have those components, and we found that swallowing was initiated when it was initiated during inspiration. It was associated with greater odds of impairment in different pharyngeal components, such as the initiation of pharyngeal swallow on the MBS-IMP, laryngeal vestibular closure, tongue-based retraction, and a greater frequency of airway invasion. We measured that using penetration aspiration scale scores.
Can you tell me a little bit how you looked at that, how you measured it? Did you look at it on fees?
Yeah. So all of this, all the data collection was done in the radiology suite. It was done using simultaneous respiratory inductance plethysmography. Along with, while they were completing their sort of like a simultaneous video fluoroscopy, we completed the video fluoroscopy using the modified barium swallow impairment profile or the MBS-IMP. So basically how it works is that the patient is sitting on a chair in the radiology suite, similar to what we do while we're doing a modified barium swallow study. And they have two bands, one across their ribcage, one across their abdomen, that allows us to get a ribcage and an abdomen signal. And they have their airflow is recorded using a nasal cannula. So we have a nasal cannula in their nose, but it does not provide any oxygen. It only lets us collect airflow.
Interesting. Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. My brain was trying to figure out, I'm like, how did you guys figure this out? How did you get those measurements? Awesome.
Yeah. Respiratory inductance plethysmography is a gold standard to measure such respiratory swallow coordination. And I don't know if I'm happy to share links to the paper, because the paper has a picture of how the signals look, how the data collection was completed.
That would be great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. What else are you working on, Rabab?
So something that a question that I have been asking myself since my clinical years is, what is the association between the perception of swallowing in patients with Parkinson's versus what we see on instrumental swallow studies? I think it all started with when I used to see patients clinically. I used to have a lot of Parkinson's patients with swallowing difficulties. It was, I remember this very vividly, because it was me in a room, a patient, and their partner. And I asked a question about their swallowing. And they were like, oh, yes, Rabab, I'm completely fine. And then their partner looked at me and they were like, no, they're not. There's a lot of coughing during mealtimes. It takes longer to eat meals. So and that was something that surprised me the first time when I was professionally younger. And then I started seeing a pattern that a lot of patients did not have this awareness about their swallowing difficulties. But I would, caregivers or people who used to live with them used to complain that things have changed. So first, I started asking a lot of more detailed questions. And that is something that really opened. It was like you're like opening up a box of worms, mm-hmm. where you're, the more questions you ask and the more you probe, the more clarity you get based on their signs and symptoms. One of my mentors is Dr. Corinne Jones from UT Austin, and something that I had heard her say at one of her presentations, and something I carry with me to this date, is always ask detailed questions. I think as clinicians, it is our responsibility to ask more probing questions. Sometimes if you ask patients like, how's your swallowing? And they're like, oh yes, I'm completely fine. And then I'm like, but do you have to cut up your steak in small pieces to eat? Then they are like, oh yeah, it's harder to chew stuff that's more tough or not easy to swallow. That is kind of a red flag for us and helps us ask more detailed questions or assess and diagnose as needed. So this question was something I was carrying with myself for a few years. And then at Northwestern, I completed a study looking at the association between patient perception and physiological swallowing evidence based on video fluoroscopy. So we collected two subjective patient-reported outcome measures. The first one was the Sydney Swallow Questionnaire, and the second one was the Swallowing Quality of Life Questionnaire or Survey. And we did find a discrepancy between the two. So we found that patients with Parkinson's disease, yes, they perceived swallowing symptoms, but they perceived their pharyngeal swallowing symptoms much more than their oral swallowing symptoms. So there was a significant association between Sydney Swallow Questionnaire and the MBS-IMP PT scores, that is the pharyngeal total scores. So with every increase in symptom severity on the MBS-IMP, they perceived worse swallowing severity or difficulty. But interestingly, we did not see that with the oral components. We also saw that for every 1 unit increase in the MBS-IMP PT or pharyngeal total scores, there was a 2.14 decrease in perceived swallowing quality of life, indicating worse quality of life. So very interestingly, there were no significant associations between MBS-IMP oral total scores and the Sydney Swallow Questionnaire or swallowing quality of life. And that was quite a surprising result, because that showed us that when there's pharyngeal swallowing difficulty, patients were more aware versus when there was an oral swallowing difficulty as seen on the MBS-IMP when we use our oral components. And then we also found a significant association between the Sydney Swallow Questionnaire and the PAS, or the Penetration Aspiration Scale scores. So greater or worse Sydney Swallow Questionnaire scores were closely related with greater or worse Penetration Aspiration Scale scores. And I think that made a lot of sense to me, because as the person who worked with these patients and collected their data, they are more likely to think about themselves having a swallowing problem or difficulty when there is greater penetration or aspiration. Because that's what you notice, right? If someone's coughing or choking or things are going down the wrong way, then they're more likely to complain about it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think that was something that the field has been talking about a long time, that patient-reported outcome measures, especially in patients with Parkinson's, do not capture the full extent of their swallowing impairments. Things might not be noticed, or patients may not share their difficulties because maybe they're not aware about it or they're compensating for it. And our job as clinicians and researchers is to encourage them to complete video fluoroscopic measures or a fee study so that we can have greater evidence and greater clarity about their dysphagia, allowing us to use the best evidence-based measures of assessment and treatment that we have.
Yeah. After doing that work, has that changed the way that you would treat a patient with Parkinson's now?
I would say yes. I think about this in two ways. The first one is, of course, clinical judgment precedes all other research studies because when you're in a room with a patient, you are the one who notices things, you're asking questions. But if there is a doubt or if there is a discrepancy in the signs or symptoms that, or if there is a discrepancy in the symptoms they tell us about, versus what you see on clinical exam, I would do a modified Williams swallow study or video fluoroscopy or some sort of instrumental swallowing exam. I think that gives us more clarity about their swallowing status, especially in patients with Parkinson's, where we know that there is a mismatch seen between what they share or what they sense about their swallowing versus what we see on instrumental swallowing exams. But there's another side of that coin, which I think as clinicians living in a developed country, we forget that not everyone has access to video fluoroscopic exams. So I think it's easy for me right now to very much advocate for video fluoroscopic exams. But if you told me 10 years ago in India that every patient with Parkinson's should have a modified Barium swallow study. But if you told me 10 years ago as an SLP in India who did not have easy access to video fluoroscopy, I would just have a hard time following that. So I do want to keep that in mind that not every clinician has easy access.
Yeah, thank you. It's a huge barrier. It's something that I find really fascinating, and I always try to keep that in mind. I love patient-reported outcome measures, and I think they give us so much valuable information, but then it is hard to, if you don't have a frame of reference to put them up against, as far as instrumental assessment, then that is your only form of clinical judgment.
Yeah, I know you had a mobile instrumental exam unit, and I'm sure there were times where patients did not have access to it or with insurance difficulties. Am I right?
Well, I mean, we would go to the patients, and sometimes some of these facilities hadn't had access to anything for years, or the patients, the closest hospital may be 3 hours away, and some of these patients are just so either medically fragile or, like you said, don't have insurance that would cover a 3-hour ambulance ride to the hospital for a modified, and then you have to weigh all those, do the cost benefit analysis of, is going, putting the patient through all that worth the results that we're going to get from the test. So that's really been my passion about mobile swallow study services, is that we're able to get to some of these really underserved areas that otherwise would not have access to this. All
Yeah,
right.
something for us to keep in mind.
Definitely.
There are a few other projects I've been working on, and these highlight normative values of swallowing, and variability, like normal or typical variability in healthy adults. These are with different mentors at different universities. So hopefully we'll have a paper out on that soon. But that's something I've been thinking about, how normal variability needs to be kept in mind by clinicians and researchers when we do exams and assessments. I know Dr. Kendria Garand and Dr. Brittany Kreckler, Dr. Kara Donahue, they've all worked on looking at variability. I know Kendria has a paper looking at presbyphagia and how there is compensatory or typical variability in older adults. And we need to know what typical swallowing is to allow us to differentiate it from neurological difficulties or dysphagia as a whole. Something I try to remember is not all variability is pathological. Sometimes when we see so many patients with dysphagia and so many swallowing difficulties, it's hard to keep that in mind.
I think that's been one of, honestly, as the more experienced I've gotten in my career, been one of the most powerful things to learn, is about what is considered a normal variant for swallowing. And that's something even that I learned with my son, is he has a very, I don't even know how to describe it, I don't even want to use the word disordered. It's not pretty, but it's functional. So for him, it's a lot of variability. And so I think that's just really fascinating, is how we look at each patient individually, but then how also do we compare them to other normative data? And is this an outlier? Is this a normal variant? I think all that stuff is so fascinating, and I think it's something we don't spend enough time really, mastering in our dysphagia. Of course, everyone wants to get to what does a disordered swallow look like, and how do we help those patients? But I think we need to really learn more about that very gray area between what is disordered and what is typical. So yeah, thank you. That's very important.
A lot of our patients compensate, and like you said, it's functional. It's sometimes it's okay not to change too many things until we need to. So that's I also think of myself in my earlier clinician days where I wanted to do something, but we don't always have to do something. It's okay to take a step back, and then check in and have regular follow-ups.
I think especially with a patient population such as Parkinson's, it is good to have that baseline data of, what does this patient's swallow look like now compared to, in a few years when things might progress and look a bit different. And like you said, we don't always have to do something. I think something we don't consider is that our patients, we're not the only specialist they're going to see, right? If you have Parkinson's, you're probably going to OT, you're probably going to PT, you're going to all of these other therapies too. So as little as we can do to keep them functional, I know that is really goes against the grain for what we do, but I think it's important to keep the whole patient picture in mind that, if there's nothing for us to fix right now, then there's nothing for us to fix right now. And, come back and, see the patient in 6 months to a year, and it may be a really drastically different picture.
I completely agree with that. I know we spoke about highlighting two papers, and the first one focuses on clinical signs. It's actually a review that came out from Dr. Michelle Chuchi's lab. The first one is it's a two-part review. The second part is written by Marianne Crosco, whose work I really admire. It focuses on basic science in Parkinson's. I think it's a really nice review for clinicians as well as researchers to read. It brings everything together. The review starts with a history of Parkinson's. It gives us the Bragg staging of Parkinson's. So it really explains more about the neural control and how it's impaired, the basal ganglia system, and how the degeneration of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra lead to difficulties that we see in Parkinson's, with dysphagia being one of them. And then we have a nice detailed summary of the signs and symptoms seen. I think both of these papers, the part one and part two of the dysphagia pathophysiology in Parkinson's, are great reads. The authors have done a great job of putting a lot of information together in this review and keeping it very much focused on translational research, which can be used in clinical context as well. And the second paper is more of a basic science paper. This is a paper by Mutal. It was done in 10 subjects with Parkinson's disease and 4 age-matched control subjects. But the interesting thing was it was all done post-mortem, and they looked at alpha-synuclein pathology in the pharyngeal nerves. And I thought that was very interesting because it gives us more information about how pathological muscular changes or pharyngeal changes can also occur in patients with Parkinson's. And I think about how that can impact swallowing. We know how we need intact pharyngeal musculature to have a very well-functioning, coordinated swallowing mechanism. Swallowing is such a precise, coordinated behavior, and having any kind of pathology such as alpha-synuclein deposition or pathology in those muscles could impact the swallowing behaviors. There's a lot of research coming out about the gut-brain axis in Parkinson's and how there is alpha-synuclein pathology seen in other areas, not only cortical areas. And that has been something I've been finding very interesting and keeping up with that literature because it can help guide our clinical assessments as well.
I think this is the perfect segue, and I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I always just love peering into the brains of other people and really what research has shaped them. And I think this is probably a good segue to how you ended up at UCSF and now really, you know, diving more into neuroscience and neuroimaging and all that really cool stuff.
Yes, I am currently a postdoctoral scholar at UCSF. I'm doing my postdoc under the mentorship of Dr. Srikanthan Nagarajan. Dr. Bonnie Martin Harris was my doctoral mentor, and I had a great, great learning experience at Northwestern under her mentorship. And Dr. Srikanthan Nagarajan has now been a great postdoc mentor. After my PhD at Northwestern, I knew that I wanted to be in the world of movement disorders, and now I work on laryngeal dystonia and vocal tremor, stuttering, and in a neuroscience speech focus lab. So while I have my expertise lies in swallowing, I'm now looking at the other side of the coin, which is speech. Same mechanism, just a different motor movement. We use neuroimaging, which is magnetoencephalography, to look at the neural correlates related to motor speech abilities in healthy adults as well as adults with movement disorders. I actually had a paper just come out looking at pitch centering in patients with laryngeal dystonia, where it's one of my fun facts that I share with people. That did you know that in the first 200 milliseconds, our pitch automatically converges to a median pitch? So in the first 200 milliseconds, we might start away from our median pitch, either at a higher pitch or a lower pitch. And our vocal mechanism and our neural mechanisms of motor speech can make pitch converge towards the median in the first 200 milliseconds. We are still looking into whether there's an auditory component for that or not, but it is something that happens in healthy adults as well as patients with laryngeal dystonia. So that has been an interesting new find. My lab has previously looked at this in Alzheimer's disease, and we did find that they have greater or their pitch centering looks different than in healthy controls. And now I'm looking at pitch perturbation in younger versus older adults. So this is an experiment that is done while the patient is lying in the MEG scanner, and they listen to their own voice, but we manipulate it such that their pitch increases or decreases. And we look at how the brain reacts to this unexpected change in pitch and how they behaviorally as well as neurally. And we compare it in different patient populations and different age, different healthy control groups.
Awesome. So fascinating. Yeah. Was there something particular that this may be a personal question that you decided to make the switch from dysphagia over to speech?
Someone told me this, that a postdoc would be a great time for me to widen my skill set.
Oh, cool.
And now I work with a group of engineers. I'm one of the few clinicians in the lab. I learned how to code last year, which was
awesome.
Quite the learning curve.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I have great mentors, a great supportive team, and a husband at home who's an engineer and who I think I asked him way too many questions during that learning period.
Awesome. What a rich learning experience, though. How cool, Rabab. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. I dysphagia helped me understand how things work at a neuromuscular pharyngeal level, but I really wanted to understand about learn more about how things work at a neural level.
Yeah.
And my postdoc with the neuroimaging experience helps me take a deeper look into that.
That's awesome. Let's switch gears a little bit. I'd love to hear more about what you're doing as far as with DRS and the Trainee Advisory Council. I know I think DRS is just I've been a member of DRS for years and years, and they've always been a wonderful organization. But I think really in the last few years, they've formed some really great committees, and I think they're just doing some really wonderful work.
Yes, it's been a pleasure to be a part of the DRS tech team. I've been there almost, it seems longer, but I think it's been a year and a half. I was at DRS in person the last conference, and it was, we really helped behind the scenes with a few seminars and webinars. I guess there are two things I would like to highlight. The first one was we recently, a week or two ago, had a webinar with previous presenters of DRS, oral presenters as well as poster presenters. And these are presenters who won awards, sharing their experiences about DRS and their experiences presenting there. So this was, I think, a great learning experience. I had two oral presentations last year at DRS, and they were my first ones. And I was very nervous, but I think a webinar like this would be a great idea for anyone to watch. Whether you're presenting at a DRS or any other conference, this has been recorded, the webinar, so it should be available online, and I'm happy to share that information as well. The second one is the DRS Stack has a mentor-mentee luncheon at the conference, and I would highly encourage anyone to attend that. There is basically a group of there is lunch provided, and there are tables assigned where we connect you with other peers that have similar questions or interests, and there's a mentor or two on every table. You can ask them questions. It's very informal. It's a great networking opportunity. I've actually met and interacted with quite a few colleagues at that luncheon and quite a few mentors. It's a great place to connect, understand how the world of dysphagia works, and it helps you think about next opportunities for yourself too.
Yeah, awesome. I don't know if I went to that luncheon last year or the year before. I think it might have even been the year before that I was at it. Yeah. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. And it's really cool to just sit at round tables with really, really smart people that have been in the field for 30, 40 years, but they just have so much to contribute, and they just want to give back to newer grads and up and coming researchers. So it's a really, really well done fun thing. So
During my luncheon, Dr. Heather Stammer from Stanford was the mentor, and she is so inspiring, and I had great questions to ask her, and she gave us some great insights into her expertise and knowledge. So I would highly recommend that people come up with a list of questions. It's a good time to ask questions. But in addition, I met a few people on my table, and they were so inspiring as well. So it's great to learn from people who've been in the field so many years, but to also learn from your peers and see how everyone else is doing things professionally and what you can learn from them, and maybe some knowledge you can share as well.
Yeah, awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Rabab. This has been so wonderful. Is there any final thoughts? Anything else you want to share?
No, this has been great. Thank you so much. I am always happy to connect, so please feel free to reach out to me. You can follow me on LinkedIn, or and we can chat, set up a time to discuss anything more. I love meeting new people, especially when they're SLPs or researchers, so I'm open to any sort of networking and collaborations as well.
Awesome. Thank you again, Rabab. It's been so nice meeting you, and thank you for sharing your work.
And that's a wrap for this episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if you'd like to download the show notes from this episode, please visit swallowyourpridepodcast.com. There you can also sign up for our email list so that you'll never miss another episode. If you do like what you hear, then please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or share it on social media with your friends and colleagues, because that is what keeps these episodes coming. If you'd like to be a guest, share feedback, or request a topic to be discussed on the show, please email podcast@teresarichard.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.